Welcome to another episode of Before You Kill Yourself with your host, Leo Flowers. I am Leo Flowers. Today's guest is Katrina Breeze, and she's here because she's an advocate for Donna's Law. Donna's Law is a bill that will limit the access one has to guns so that we can't make that impulsive purchase when we are in the throes of a suicidal ideation or some type of psychiatric or mental break. Katrina Breeze, welcome to the episode.
Thanks, Leo.
Talk to me about why you created and advocated for Donna's Law.
Sure. I lost my mom to an impulsive gun suicide. And like many Americans, she purchased the gun that she killed herself with that same day. She had been in psychiatric care for her partner had quit his job to stay home with her between hospital stays. She was under the care of a psychiatrist. Our family really did everything we could. That day when she left the house, our family called the police 5 times to get help so that she would not purchase a gun. And in Louisiana, where I live, and like many states, there's no barrier to purchase a gun for most people. My mom was able to purchase a gun, the first gun she ever had, without a license, within moments of leaving her house. She had gone on her phone and typed in how to hang herself. And then Google showed her some articles, and the first article explained that the outcome of hanging yourself would likely be unsuccessful, and it described a lot of the permanent damage that you could do to your body with that. And then it encouraged her to buy a handgun, and then she Googled gun stores in New Orleans and went to the nearest gun store where she purchased a gun that I feel is designed to put in one's mouth because it is small and has no safety, and I have a lot of issues with that too. But she purchased the gun and a box of breast cancer awareness bullets and went to the public park and shot herself. And like anyone who loses somebody, my brain immediately started thinking about ways this could have been different and what could we have done and what could have stopped this from happening. And it seemed really clear that if my mom had been able to self-advocate and voluntarily opt out of her ability to purchase a gun, she would still be alive. So Donna's Law enables people to do just that. People who feel that they're at risk for an impulsive gun purchase. This isn't for people who already have guns. This is for people who typically do not have guns and do not want to own guns. And it's completely voluntary, and it also is reversible. So this is a great new tool for people to be able to use to prevent impulsive suicide.
I love it because even in San Francisco, you see that they've put nets up to prevent impulsive suicides. There was a story that I shared on a recent podcast about a guy who was going to jump, and an officer happened to get there in time, and they talked for a good, I think, two or three hours, and the guy changed his mind. And now, you know, he's giving talks and he's on a tour. And so this idea that there are times where it definitely is impulsive. These examples show it, because it's not like the guy was going to jump, the officer showed up, talked him out of it, and then he jumped immediately. No, he went on to live his life and thrive and find a way to flourish. So this law is so valuable.
Thank you. Yeah. I was going to say that a couple of years ago, I had a mother call me that was suicidal, that had read about my story and was extremely desperate and suicidal. And she called me and we stayed on the phone for a couple hours. And eventually she just got hungry because we had been on the phone so long. And just the simple change and shift in her body of being hungry, then the suicidality had, you know, had to take a back seat, and she went out and had sushi instead. So, you know, we have a lot of myth about what suicide looks like, and you know, there is that impulsivity, there is that ability to intervene. One of the myths around suicide is that if they don't have this, then they'll just find another way, which isn't true at all. And studies show that, first off, guns are the most lethal means that someone could use, and there is not much time for intervention. For example, like overdosing on pills has a very long period of chance for intervention and for the person to intervene on their own about what they're doing and save themselves. And then also it has a low lethality. So someone who tries that method is likely to not succeed. Guns is just a whole different level. You can't put the bullet back in the chamber. Most people who use this method are going to die. And most suicides now are by gun, and most gun deaths are suicide. And when we think about most gun deaths being suicide, that depending on the state, that's between 60 and 80% of gun deaths. And then when you look at the other gun deaths, the homicides, the domestic disputes, the family annihilations, so many of those also involve a suicide, school shootings, workplace shoot-ups. So many of those people have sought out psychiatric care, have self-advocated for psychiatric care, are having an impulsivity issue that is observed, and this is a way for them to take control. And I mean, like, when I imagine a dad shooting his family in an impulsive reaction from a drug, I mean, I can't imagine a sadder scenario than being that man right then, and then, you know, killing themselves. And that just breaks my heart that there aren't the guardrails in society to help protect someone that knows that they want that protection.
Yeah, because, you know, I think you've mentioned, I don't know if you've mentioned it this time, this Katrina has been very gracious in letting us re-record, because we were recording earlier and then I forgot to hit the record button. But in our previous conversation, you were talking about how your mom was in psychiatric care and sought psychiatric treatment. Can you talk to us about what that looked like? Did she check herself in once, and what did she check? What was she seeking psychiatric care for?
Sure. My mom had great care. She had a psychiatrist that she loved that she had been working with for over a decade. She was on medications that she had voluntarily taken. And in the months leading up to her death, she had voluntarily committed herself 3 times to psychiatric care. The stays, I suspect, lasted about 2 weeks, some of them. Our family even tried to get her back in to the hospital because she was so suicidal and impulsive and just not in control of herself because of this drug reaction that she was having, in addition to also likely being in a mixed state from bipolar. And a lot of other things in life were going on. Like, sometimes I think there's 100 things that led to my mom's suicide. I think that her medical history, other medications she had been on, different things like that. Also her partner quit his job so that he could stay home with her between hospital stays. On the day that she died, her partner called the police 5 times to get help because he was afraid that she was going to kill herself. And there was nothing that they could do to stop a gun purchase.
I mean, I'm so glad that you're bringing up the compounding effect of different things that have led to that moment. Because I think a lot of times when you read an article in a newspaper or see something in the news or on Twitter or social media, they always try to whittle it down to one thing. They're like, oh, they ended their life because they had mental health issues. And it's such a blanket statement. Oh, they were struggling with depression. And then we don't talk about there were financial struggles. They may have been in a mixed episode. There were medication changes. There was job loss. They may have felt like a burden because now their partner is quitting their job to take care of them. They tried to check themselves in a number of times, but the medication has to change and they haven't figured out the right dosage. Like all these compounding effects, what were the medications that your mom was taking at the time? And had it been consistent or were they changing?
Well, she would not tell me the medications that she was on. As a in our whole life together, which was 40 years, her medications were definitely a point of strife in our relationship. And she had been on a number of drugs that over the years that caused addiction. And when I would inquire about them, she would get angry at me. And I do think that that scenario is not uncommon in families where you have someone that has prescriptions, legally it's theirs to take, it's no one's business. But when you're seeing side effects and you're trying to help someone, there's also shame about them not wanting to share the names of drugs with you or to hear. I mean, I know my mom didn't want to hear my judgments about what drugs she was on or for in any way me to question them. And so eventually in life, I just stopped completely asking because that was grounds for getting kicked out of her house if I were to ask that. The only reason I knew about Effexor was because after her death, her partner gave me a journal that she had kept. And she had never kept a journal in her entire adulthood. So the fact that she had a journal was very bizarre to me. And the entire journal was about Effexor. And the whole thing was just her counting down the days of getting off Effexor and trying to process and be brave through the side effects and praying to get through it. And on the last journal entry, she only has 7 days left of the drug, and it took about 6 months to get off it. So it was just a horrible saga of the effects of Effexor all written out by my mom, left behind.
It sounds so painful. I mean, 6 months. And because, I mean, just put it in perspective, when we think about detoxing from a drug, that usually, you know, the worst of it is 5 days, but it usually takes anywhere from 2 weeks to a month to detox. But for this prescription drug, something handed to you by a doctor, it's taking your mom about 6 months to get off of it. What were some of the side effects that she was experiencing that, you know, prompted her to pull out a journal and start writing down the experiences of it?
Probably the most extreme was intense insomnia that lasted for months. Like, she literally did not sleep for weeks before she died. And she would say that she was in a constant panic attack all the time. And then she was also having lots of pain, extreme tremors. Like, she couldn't eat with a fork anymore because she would have stabbed her face with the fork. And so she had to eat with her hands, like paws. And she could barely walk. She went from looking like being a 67-year-old woman to looking like she was 100 years old. She became extremely frail. She was very isolated. She didn't want to see anybody. She was very embarrassed about what was happening to her. She was hearing voices. And those are just the things that I know that have, you know, kind of come up through talking to her partner. But I'm sure it was even more than that that she was dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, and then that on top of whatever naturally occurs with bipolar, can you talk to us about what that looked like to you as a child growing up with someone with bipolar? Like, what was the range of behaviors, thoughts, moods?
Sure. My mom was pretty much fine most of my childhood and just like a normal mom, just a little extra fun. And then when I was 12 years old, and so she was about 40, her brother was diagnosed with AIDS and he became extremely sick. And at that time, she went to therapy for that and was prescribed Prozac. And she had an extreme reaction to Prozac. It launched her into a manic episode. She disappeared from our home. She ran away. She was psychotic, just like on the loose, gone for 3 months. At the time, the doctors gave her a 3-month supply of Prozac and just kind of like led her on her way. Like nowadays, they would be a lot more careful about like symptoms of mania, but back then they weren't. And that was the beginning of the journey, I guess, you know, of the saga. And then she came home and she crashed from that and was depressed, extremely depressed, and suicidal. And then was also given a lot more prescriptions that led to more addictions. Like she was addicted to Ativan and I don't even know what else, but it was a cycle of drugs kind of helping, drugs making it worse, drugs kind of helping for 25 years.
And what support, if any, did you receive as a child going through all this? Or was it, did you not even think it was a thing to, did they needed to be addressed? Or you just like, oh, this is mom being mom, dad being dad, and life being life?
Yeah, I guess there was a lot of secrecy about my mom's mental health and about the medications and pill addiction and things like that. Being a teenager, I was very exploitive of the freedom of not having a mom that was paying attention and that was like on pills in bed and not going to get up. It would probably be very different today, but when I was growing up, my mom's pills were just in a drawer in the kitchen. And so there were some like really heavy drugs in there. At times there was oxys, there was benzos and even like morphine and things like that were in that drawer. And so at different times I would like get into that in my teen years. And I think I feel like I did get like some therapy, but it was so long ago and I've been in therapy more recently and I appreciate it and it's been very helpful. But when I think back on the therapy that I got 20 years ago, it was really just like nothing. Like it had no value.
Yeah. It's when I was in therapy when I was very young and I just wasn't ready for it. And nor did I see the value, and I was like, this is stupid. But now that I'm actively wanting to go to therapy and I have more perspective, I'm like, this is so valuable, and I'm so grateful for it now. But any therapist that's working with kids, they have their or young people, they have their work cut out for them, because it just requires different mechanisms of treatment. Did your mom, did she have like physical ailments? Because, you know, you're talking about some painkillers in that drawer also. Were there any physical ailments that she had struggled with?
Yeah. So she had a suicide attempt around that time and with pills, and it did not kill her. But when the paramedics picked her up, they dropped her. And it caused an injury in her spine. And forever after, she dealt with that injury. And that's actually very common for people who, you know, it's very common for someone to try and commit suicide and then end up with a permanent injury in their life. And then, you know, some people, most of those people won't even go on to try it again. I mean, from what I've seen, it's like 90% of people won't try it again. But I mean, there's a lot of loss experienced from that too.
You talk about now finding value in therapy. What brought you to therapy recently?
I guess being forced into it by needing it so bad. After my mom died, I did a little bit of grief therapy with hospice. They offer free sessions in a lot of states, and I went to that, and that was very helpful for kind of like in the beginning emergency therapy to get you through the first couple of months, and also to address like some of the risks that happen to people at that in that period of time when you're experiencing a sudden trauma like that, and then all of a sudden it feels like you kind of have brain damage and you end up like crashing your car or like falling down the stairs or just like in general being like so preoccupied and frazzled. And, you know, maybe there are some like neurological metrics that could be observed that happen. So yeah, in that period, I did that type of therapy. And then I was experiencing complex PTSD about a year after my mom died. And at first it was a lot of fear about kind of rational things like, oh, I'm scared to drive my car because there's a lot of carjackings. And I live in New Orleans, so it's legit, kind of. or, you know, things like that. And then it just got more and more that anytime I thought about leaving my house, my brain would play almost like a movie of bad things that could happen to me. And it would just keep making up more and more. And I'm a creative. So my brain could just like come up with like an endless amount of bad things that could happen to me if I went outside. And it was exhausting. And then there was this one day where I was like, I'm not gonna survive this. Like if I allow my brain to put me in this much fear, like eventually I'm probably gonna kill myself because this is so miserable. And there was a lot of physical pain too that came with it, like just all the tension of it, like headaches and back aches and bad sleep and things like that. And then there was this one day where I was like too scared to go out. And then in my head, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to bed where it's safe. And then my brain played this whole scenario of this hammerhead shark being in my bed. Like it was like Jaws gonna get me and like totally like freaked me out. And I was like, wow, I'm really losing my mind. Because there's just zero chance there's a hammerhead in my bed. And then I did just walk into a clinic and make an appointment, and I did a couple therapy sessions, and I went to, they recommended a psychiatrist. So I went to them, and then they showed me a chart of medications, and I just like couldn't go there because I had seen all the damage it had done to my mom on medications. And I just don't feel like confident with that as a tool for me. You know, maybe because of my genetic makeup, you know, I just am, I feel a little bit too sensitive to those drugs. And also other people in my family have also had suicide, died by suicide. And so I do feel like I have to be really careful with all kinds of medications, like even like birth control. And there's a lot out there that can cause suicidality. So I kind of ended that therapy, and I had a friend come over that is a healer, and she was like, I want you to take these mushrooms and make art with me. So we did that, and it truly changed everything. It like reset my fear. And after that, I was actually able to do work that could help me heal. And at that point, I actually got a free subscription to BetterHelp because they were partnered with Everytown to support gun violence survivors. And I utilized that for 4 years. And I feel like I got a lot out of that. I think that probably one of like the biggest lessons I got out of it was like, this is going to hurt forever. Learn to build a life that, you know, can succeed despite that. And yeah, now I'm not currently in any therapy, although I would welcome another free subscription to BetterHelp if they want to give me one.
That's awesome. I mean, it's one of the sponsors of this podcast, so I don't want people to think that we brought you on just to plug it. Like I wasn't right. aware that you had a 4-year relationship with them, but it's good. It makes me feel good because, you know, when I think about who's sponsoring the podcast and who I want to work with, I want to be people who or organizations who are doing work that align with my values, and I think would be a benefit to the listeners. So I appreciate that free plug that you have for them.
Yeah, and no problem. I'm grateful for them.
Yeah, you know, because I've been using online therapy too. I mean, I'm not using BetterHelp. I had my therapist before BetterHelp became a sponsor. But just the fact that just teletherapy, it's just, it mm-hmm. works. It's so dope. I don't have to like sit in traffic and then sit in the office and then, you know, or sitting in a waiting area. I had a situation once where I was going to therapy, and as I'm going in, somebody I knew was coming out, and it was like so awkward. And then there's this new Netflix documentary, American Symphony, with John Batiste and his wife. And there's some scenes in there where he's talking to his therapist on phone. But I will say I crave going to see someone in person. I'll be honest about that. Like, as effective as online therapy has been, and me and my girlfriend, we have a couples therapist that we've been seeing via Zoom, but I'm just like, you know, to physically be in this, like, it's just different. It's just going to be a different energy. So your 4-year subscription with BetterHelp ended, and the mushrooms came into play, art came into play.
Mm-hmm.
How else are you taking care of yourself? How else are you managing it? And was there anything from therapy that, any exercises or tools or strategies from therapy that you're continuing to practice?
Well, with BetterHelp, there's a lot of journaling. And so there's a lot of like self-reflecting. And when you're writing to your therapist, you're also writing. So you're reading your own words. And that had a lot of value to me. So I feel like I'm trying to be like more open and honest with my friends about what kind of mood I am in. And it is extremely hard to be openly sad when you are a parade producer in Mardi Gras in New Orleans. Like, I feel like my whole career is on the line if I'm not happy, and that I am tasked with making so many people happy, and that I can't, let's say, like right now it's carnival season. Like, I wouldn't dare like put anything online about being anything less than happy. just because I don't have the, I guess, like economic freedom to be authentic, I guess, in that. And I probably could use more therapy. I could probably use more walks. I try and spend time with friends when I'm sad. I feel like that really helps me a lot. Like, just to have a conversation with a friend, even if it's not about anything sad, just to laugh and be funny. And I try and get into focus with my art, but that's also really difficult because as a creative, it's kind of like waiting for that like elusive orgasm of creativity to just like surface. And it can be hard to generate that when you're depressed and can't focus. A lot of the joys in my life, I feel like, haven't been joyous since my mom died anymore. And sometimes when I, like in the beginning, when I would do stories about Donna's Law, I felt that the way that the story would be told was that I was a person that had a really happy life, and then this sad thing happened to me, and then I created Donna's Law, and through that saved lives, and now I'm happy and like happily ever after. And it's really not true. Like, I think that I'll forever struggle with it, and I don't know that there's any like therapy that is gonna fix it. I feel like therapy often gets me back to working, or gets me back in like the flow of the rat race, but it doesn't necessarily change how often I cry or something like that.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that a lot of people go into therapy thinking or wanting it to fix them, cure them, eliminate whatever the pain or sorrow or grief is. And what I've discovered is really, for me, therapy has been more about learning how to live with it. It's almost like someone who has, chronic pain or they've lost their vision. It's like therapy is not going to bring your vision back, but therapy can teach you how to cope with life without vision, or how to reframe it so that it's not something that you start compounding, because there's what happens to you naturally, right? And then there's like how we react to it that can compound and make it worse. It's like you go through a breakup. So like, you either are going to go drink yourself to death because of the breakup, so now you're compounding the pain, or you're going to say, you're going to cry and, watch, When Harry Met Sally, and then you're going to, get back out there or what have you, or focus on your work, or, go into something more productive. So to me, I view therapy as something that prevents me from doing more harm than what's already been done. Not creating more pain.
Yeah, that's a good point. When my mom died, I had several friends whose mothers had already passed at that point. And in all of my friends, I observed a lot of self-destruction after their mothers died. And in a lot of ways made their lives a lot worse than it needed to be, and then created patterns that had impacts for many, many years, if not forever. And when my mom died, I felt like, oh, wow, like that could happen to me. Like, I cannot do that. I can't afford for my life to, you know, be lost to this. And that's when that was part of my work with Donna's Law, was just to, instead of drink it away, you know, to whenever I'm having like a moment of sadness, to just like reach out to somebody and reach out to a stranger. Like, I think I wrote to you on Christmas Eve. Like, I was just like sad, and I was like, I'm going to write to some podcast hosts, and, you know, maybe we can save some lives.
I know. I remember receiving that email and being like, what? Like, this person is really passionate about this law and what they have to say, you know, sending me the email. I remember receiving that. And actually just being impressed with the dedication and commitment that you've exhibited. How do you even get a bill? Like, how did you make your way up the hill to Congress? Like, how does that even work? Like, if I want to do Leo's sure. law, how many petitions sure. do I need?
Well, I didn't get any petitions. The way that it worked out for me was my mom died in 2018, and at that point, I wanted to make a Louisiana legislation called Donna's Law in Louisiana. And then the newspaper did a story about it, and they found an expert who is a law professor at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. And he had previously conceived a legislation that was the same thing. And he had just passed it in Washington State. And he had been working on it for a long time, but finally got a little bit of traction. And so the newspaper reporter told me his name and gave me his contact info and said, you know, I think this guy could be a really great partner for you. And I reached out to him. And then the last 5 years, he's been my partner. I'm his partner on doing this work and taking it all over the country. And I've gotten to meet him, and he has an amazing family, and I've stayed at his house in Birmingham a couple times, and I feel like he's one of my best friends now. So it's really magical to have someone like him come into my life. Because there are, so sometimes I do think about like, how would you start a law, and like what the first path you would take would be. And a lot has to do with precedent. Like, has this been passed anywhere? Has anything similar ever happened like this? And so one of the precedents to this law is that there is legislation that enables people who have gambling addiction to opt out of their ability to enter a casino. And that is, a lot of the people that are signed up for that also have impulsive psychosis and things like bipolar. And this legislation protects them from that. And we also have things like advanced directives, where someone can say, like, in the future, if I'm incapacitated, these are the things that I want to happen. We have things like Antabuse, which enable, I believe that works for people with alcohol use disorder, and it like blocks their ability to consume alcohol, and I think it makes them sick. So that is a similar tool that people are using for alcoholism. So there are a lot of examples of ways that people can set themselves up in the now, when they're in their self-preservation mode, because they fear impulsivity and psychosis.
I wish they had that for donuts, like just to block me from buying donuts, because I have spent a life, I've spent a life savings worth of
Yeah, I hear you. I think we should be able to block whatever we want with our credit cards. Like I saw a bill in Pennsylvania, it didn't pass, but it was moving forward about registering yourself to not be able to purchase alcohol. So like I'm a retired cigarette smoker. It would have been great to create that prevention tool for myself. I sometimes think about it, I wish I could block Amazon.
Oh, you seriously. Know, yep.
There's so many things that we could benefit from this type of structure to protect ourselves.
Yeah, block my girlfriend from buying Amazon.
Yeah, well, I feel that's like not voluntary.
I feel like I'm the breaker of boxes in this household.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything about Donna's Law that we haven't discussed that you think would be of value to my listeners?
Sure. So people can use Donna's Law currently. It currently exists in Washington State, Virginia, and Utah. And people there can put themselves on the list. Each state has a different process, but if you go on donnaslaw.com, you can start your process there. We are also working in a dozen states currently to bring Donna's Law to those states. And we have the intention of bringing it to all 50 states, plus DC, plus federal. And as we get there, we can really benefit a lot from constituents, enabling us to utilize their constituency to help us make connections to their representatives. So, for example, I live in Louisiana. When I'm doing work in another state, there should be someone from that state that wants this to happen, that helps me make the introductions within that state. And then Fred and I can do most of the work from there. We also have support from NAMI and AFSP and a lot of other gun violence prevention and mental health and suicide prevention groups. So yeah, if people want to help out, they can go to donnaslaw.com. They can learn about it. They can talk about it. Even just talking to people about this option is so helpful. Like, I feel like we're building a conversation nationwide, and I see the value of that conversation spreading. Even when we don't have a law passed, just talking about Donna's Law shows people that the connection between guns and suicide and the value of separating someone from lethal means, and also just knowing the gun laws where you live, because I didn't know the gun laws where I lived. I didn't know that my mom was at risk for this. So yeah, those are some ways for people to connect with this.
Yeah, it's so strange that I live in California, and I don't know what the waiting period is to buy a gun here in California. But my friend has got a divorce, and it's like a 6-month waiting period to divorce. So if you file for a divorce in June, it can't be finalized until like December or January. And I'm like, wow, we have these things in place for divorce, but not for guns, which, you know, it's incomprehensible to me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's not for lack of care from society. There's a misconception that America just doesn't care about what's happening with gun violence. And people really, really do care. People are heartbroken across America for what's going on with gun violence. We are being slaughtered by politics. And the ability for our government to move forward in any protections for us, including something as simple as Donna's Law, which does not interfere with the Second Amendment, is totally voluntary, confidential, reversible, and we're still struggling through the politics.
Penultimate question, Katrina. I always imagine there's one person listening in who may be on the precipice of wanting to end their life. Before you kill yourself, what would you say to them?
What do you want to eat? Yes, I think if you're thinking about killing yourself, and then you think about what you want to eat and think about your favorite things to eat, then hopefully, you know, the chemicals in your mind will start changing and you will start thinking about your favorite foods. When I was a kid, I would do this thing with my mom where she would be so depressed and pretty much catatonic. And I would lay in bed with her and I would just start listing different kinds of pie. Like I'd be like blueberry pie, pecan pie. And I would just like sit there and name 20 pies. And then, but I would save her favorite pies so that she could say them, you know? And I just feel like that tool is great, you know? Look at go on YouTube and watch some cooking videos and get hungry.
Oh, I love a cooking video. I love it. Watching people bake bread or make anything from scratch, I'm mm-hmm. all in. I could watch it all day. Last question. What are you looking forward to in the next 24 hours?
You know, I'm making these giant flowers. I was thinking about you all day, Leo Flowers. So I'm looking forward to getting those done. I have two costume commissions that are for a Alice in Wonderland theme parade here called the Crew of Mad Hatters. And they're having me do two of the talking flowers from Alice in Wonderland. So they're one's going to be a giant tiger lily and one's an iris. And so I'm looking forward to putting the finishing touches on those in the next 24 hours.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure that they will. This would be televised. Would it be YouTube videos of this parade?
Oh, yeah, it is televised.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Beautiful. Well, I'll look out for it and I'll look out for your craftsmanship. On YouTube. Thank you so much, Katrina. Thank you so much, listeners, for tuning in. Remember, this podcast is not a substitute for calling the 988 or any of the 800 numbers listed in all the show notes. You can chat, talk, or text. Please go to thrivewithleo.com for one-on-one coaching with yours truly. Let's get to tomorrow together. Thank you so much, Katrina.
Thank you.